Hello and welcome to Inside Briefing, the podcast from the Institute for Government. I'm Emma Norris. Parliament is still in recess, so this week's podcast is going to have something of an international flavour. We're going to be taking a look at the Foreign Office. A new report has made headlines for suggesting that the department needs a makeover and should put the colonial era paintings into storage. But there's a lot more to the report than that, and its author will join us today. From Foreign Office to Foreign Secretary, David Cameron, Lord Cameron of Chipping Norton, to give him his full title, has been in the US for meetings with, amongst others, Donald Trump. We'll look at what Cameron's up to and review his performance since he returned to government. One of the biggest challenges facing Cameron, in fact facing foreign ministers, diplomats and leaders all over the world, is the crisis in the Middle East. It's also beginning to impact on the work of civil servants here in London too. We'll be taking a look at what's going on. Joining me throughout are a top IFG duo, Alex Thomas, who runs our civil service programme, and Tim Durrant, who leads all our work on ministers. Hi, both.
Hi, Emma.
And I'm delighted that we're also joined today by Tom Fletcher, former ambassador, former foreign policy advisor at Number 10, the principal of Hertford College, and one of the authors of the World in 2040 report. Hi, Tom. Thanks for being with us.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on.
So we're going to start with that report and with the Foreign Office. Tom, can you give us a quick lowdown? Who wrote the report with you? What's it for and what's it trying to do?
Well, thank you. I mean, it's been a fascinating week, actually. I mean, the report came out on Monday. We got together towards the end of last year here at Hertford College, a really interesting group of former national security advisors, former permsecs, former ambassadors, senior development people, and really just threw around this question on, you know, what is the context for foreign policy making over the next 20 years. And we were quite keen not to just sit there and do the classic thing, which is armchair generals, retired diplomats. There's nothing as an ex-diplomat, as I know, being one, kind of harumphing about how life was always better in our day. And if only everyone had adopted our kind of pet project, then the world would be a better place. But rather than do that, we tried to sort of brainstorm what is the world and going to be like in which we're trying to make policy, and what's our advice therefore, not really just to the next government. And some of the coverage has said, you know, is this meant to be a manifesto or a set of policy proposals for whoever wins the election in at the end of the year, but actually to try and write something for the next three or four governments and to really think about what are the sort of stable foundations on which we can build a more comprehensive, kind of coherent foreign policy. So that was the kind of genesis of the work. And, you know, we had a fantastic day and a half here at Hertford, and obviously a whole range of views. And there was no way we were ever going to capture the views of 30, 40 of these people, all with very firm, independent ideas on the world in one document. So what we did was that working with the UCL Policy Lab, where Mohsen Malik is also a kind of visiting professor of practice, we tried to draw together what we thought were the main ideas. And much of that work was done by Mohsen, former director general at FCDO, and by me, but by the team of experts too, who really kind of drove that process. And all of that, you know, under the watchful eye of Mark Sedwill, who of course knows these issues as well as anyone who's worked in government. I think seven prime ministers he said he's worked closely with. And he's obviously worked at the top of ministries, but also at the very center of Number 10 as cabinet secretary and as national security advisor. So that was the sort of basic team that did the work on it. It's quite funny, you know, over the weekend, we were all saying to ourselves, is there anything we can do to make sure that more than three people read the report? And we were pretty confident you guys would read it. And a few other kind of like-minded, kind of the people who are thinking about these issues and get excited about the machinery of government and how do we, you know, reform the structures at the center of government to deliver great policy outcomes. We hadn't expected it to cut through in the way that it did. And, you know, James Landale, who wrote the initial piece on the BBC about the report, told us yesterday it's had 1 million hits. You know, for all of us who work on these issues around government and future of government, it's fairly surprising. And we can maybe dig into why that was. But that's the genesis of the project.
And tell us a bit about exactly what you're arguing in the report, Tom. Is it that the Foreign Office is out of date, that it's in need of a new purpose? Or what are the central things that you're setting out?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because it's been fascinating to see the way in which different bits of the media have chosen to present the report. And, you know, some pretty misleading headlines, of course. You know, that I've been reading that apparently we want to abolish the Foreign Office. We want to make a big bonfire in Durbar Court and dance around it in a sort of festival of woke burning anything, you know, from before 2000, and generally, you know, delighting in the end of Britishness, and sort of celebrate how much we hate our country and so on. As you guys know, having read it, that's very much not the thrust of the recommendations. I'd say, look, what we're really trying to do is to say it's a world in flux. The challenges that we're dealing with, these multi-layered challenges that on your podcast you discuss all the time, climate change, conflict, artificial intelligence, the difficulty of governing in an age of distrust, alongside this issue around our national purpose and this effort to try and find our place in the world post-Brexit, in a world that's changing fast around us. That's the context. And so that demands a different set of skills, but also a much clearer effort to join up the different bits of foreign policy machinery across defense, diplomacy, development, but also linking, as Jonathan Black's report recently argued, linking to economic security as well. And to try and deal with the fact on so many of these issues, the distinction between overseas and domestic is completely blurred. And to try and think, well, what's the machinery then you need at the center to respond to the fact that those challenges interplay with each other in that way? I'd highlight two or three things. One, we thought that there should be not the end of the Foreign Office, but actually an enhanced department, Ministry for International Affairs. Doesn't really matter what you call it. We can all get into a great kind of culture war over what we should call it, but something that does join up those different instruments of governing and of policy more effectively. We thought to do that, you've got to resource it. And we've got these brilliant diplomats, brilliant development people. And of course, the three of us pulling this report together, we are enormous fans, it goes without saying, of the people doing that work who are actually marching towards the sound of gunfire in order to stop it. But how do you give them the resources to do that? And we're arguing you need that 1% of GNI commitment, rather than thinking about the 0.7%, which is so important to many of us, and the 2% alongside that for defense, 1% for this work on climate change, development, and diplomacy. Diplomacy often gets squashed out of that equation. And then I suppose the other thing I'd highlight is that need for us to operate in that much more strategic way. I did this series for the BBC recently on the battle for liberal democracy. And one of the sobering conclusions was, you know, this thing we hear all the time, that the autocracies are often getting better at being strategic, at thinking longer term. And, you know, I worked for three prime ministers in 4 years. There have been periods in recent UK history when three prime ministers lasted 4 weeks. And that is a real challenge. You know, I can't remember the number. Is it some 19 African ministers in 12 years and so on? Mm-hmm. And so there are all sorts of challenges there around foreign policy making. And my experience in the Middle East and Lebanon, you know, when we were effectively playing poker with Putin over the region and so on, was that that lack of strategic depth is a real challenge for foreign policy making. And so we wanted to think about how to reset that.
Thanks, Tom. Tim, just picking up on what Tom's just set out, the level of ministerial churn, for instance, that we've seen in the Foreign Office. There are some recommendations in the report that are very much in line with some of the things that we've argued here at the Institute. Ministers should be serving longer in post. There should be more involvement of outsiders like think tanks in the policymaking process. Did that resonate with you?
Yeah, absolutely. And as Tom said, you know, it's no surprise that we were sort of all over this because it was about departments and ministers and structures and processes, which is, of course, what we love here. And yeah, absolutely. You know, we've said in any sphere, not just foreign policy, having ministers in post for a decent amount of time so they can really get to know the issues, they can really build the relationships that matter, is a hugely important way of making government more effective. And as Tom has alluded to, you know, we've seen massive churn in ministerial tenure over the last decade and a half, but particularly since the Brexit referendum. I think that point about sort of being more open is a really interesting one as well. And that's obviously something, you know, we think tanks are a good idea, and we think that they should have more influence inside government or be able to talk perhaps to more of government. Both of those things, though, are political judgments as much as they are kind of institutional setups, and particularly ministers. You know, ministers are moved by prime ministers or because they have to resign because of scandal. So that relies on PMs deciding, no, I'm going to keep my Africa minister, for example, to take Tom's example, in post, and I'm going to let them build the relationships with the governments in the countries that they are sort of working with, rather than shuffling them on every year or every 18 months. And same with being more open, right? If the Foreign Sec says, I want to know what people in these universities or these organizations think about this issue, then the Foreign Office can make that happen. If they don't do that, and if they take sort of advice from a closed circle, then the department is going to follow that lead.
And then just on the question of institutional setup, Tom's just told us, about the argument for revamping the Foreign Office into a new international affairs ministry with a kind of clear long-term mission. It was only a few years ago that we saw DFID and the FCO merged, and part of the reason for that was similar. Does that mean that the merger hasn't worked?
The merger is an ongoing piece of work, I think. There was an NAO report about it a couple of weeks ago, which said, there's a lot of it has been a success, but there's still more to do. I think part of the reason why it came about, or a large part of the reason, was Boris Johnson, as Prime Minister, decided to make it happen, but it was born out of his frustration as Foreign Secretary with what he saw as, I think, two major parts of the UK's current foreign policy world, diplomacy and development, not working well together. But as you kind of implied, there are other bits of foreign policy that aren't sitting under the FCDO roof, and maybe they should be. There's trade, there's climate stuff. Obviously, defence is a huge part and a sort of growing importance. The sort of bigger point here that I would make, and it's what Tom said, right, is the idea that I think you can separate all of foreign policy from domestic policy anymore is just not true. It's the Jonathan Black's report for Blavatnik as well. And so it kind of doesn't matter how you cut up the departments. What matters is that they're talking to each other.
And Alex, Tom's called for a rethink of what the UK wants to achieve through its foreign policy. Is this our kind of reckoning with the UK's status and levels of influence in 2024 and beyond?
Yeah. I mean, before coming to that, I just note that, a million is actually a pretty modest number of downloads for an IFG report. So that is a joke for the avoidance of doubt, Tom. One of the things that I took from the paper was this kind of framework that Tom and his colleagues came up with about the UK being a particular type of power that benefits enormously from the international rules-based order, from trade, and our economy is based around trade, from services and service provision as being a large part of our economy, of a country where we do have natural resources, and we've got obviously sort of demographic and population resources, but fewer than other countries in the world. And so I was interested in the sort of categorization question that the paper did, and put us in that kind of tier of countries who are heavily reliant on trade and rules-based order and so on. I suppose my question to Tom around that was that sort of naturally put us in with the New Zealands and the Islands, and not in your words with the Germanys and the Frances, because we're outside the EU. Question: do we have more in common actually with Germany and France than with New Zealand? And this kind of reckoning of the major powers, the United States, the China's, the India, presumably, is it right to put us in with the kind of New Zealands rather than with the Frances and the Germanys? I don't know, sort of throw it back to Tom, really.
So, Alex, I think that's a really good point, actually. So I think if we're looking at the diplomatic influence, combining diplomacy in its broadest form with defence and development in that, then yes, we should be comparing ourselves to the Frances and the Germanys. I think the reason we took the approach we did was exactly that we were trying to think, are there examples of countries that aren't part of a major bloc that are able to do this in an agile, creative, influential way, which is why we looked at that slightly broader set of countries. But in terms of the sort of league table of heft in the world, and David Cameron in Washington with Antony Blinken, we'd be thinking of ourselves, I think, as punching at the same weight, to use that terrible cliche, as a France or a Germany, rather than some of the other offshore nations that we compared ourselves to in the report.
And I suppose, actually, I mean, sort of arguing against myself a little bit, thinking about the diplomatic influence of Ireland, we'll have a bit of that in terms of the way they achieve their national objectives. I mean, the other thought that it prompted is, we talk a lot in the domestic setting about the civil service stewardship of long-term objectives for the country, and we talk about the responsibility for the civil service to own more of its own capability, and have played around a lot and talked a lot on this podcast in the past, so I won't repeat it, about ideas that might embed the civil service's responsibility and then accountability for its own capability. So the obvious thing, the other thing I alighted on in the report was the points about long-term, about the UK's long-term interests and how those could be embedded in institutions. Now, clearly a lot of that is about the politics and about, as you've touched on, about ministers and politicians staying in office for long enough and having a clear view of strategic objectives. I was struck by how you might embed the long-term sort of quasi-permanent interests of the UK, possibly in legislation, possibly effectively in the Foreign Office, or whatever you call it, as a long-term institution. But then how you reconcile that with the democratic imperative that ministers decide and governments get what they do, I think it's a really interesting question. We've got ideas on the domestic side, but we should sort of combine forces perhaps with the global international perspective.
I think that's a brilliant challenge to take away. And actually, it's probably, dare I say, easier to do this for foreign policy, where certainly in my experience, there was immense amounts of continuity between the different administrations, different prime ministers I worked for. And where we argue about some nuances, and again, maybe China is an interesting example where the nuances become more important. But overall, the overall parameters of our approach to the world are not that different from administration to administration. And so I think it should be easier in some ways to set out what our values and interests and alliances need to be in the world. And I suppose part of what the report was trying to do was also that inject that realism into the conversation about how the world sees us. So perhaps it was a slight reaction to some of the tone of our foreign policy in recent years, where we've at times gone around saying, we are world beating at everything, and we are the number one, and listen to us. And the rest of the world kind of chuckles at that, if we're honest. So just being more honest about where we are really great at things, and showing rather than telling people that we're great at things, and rebuilding that trust. Trust is the essential currency here of foreign policy, and rebuilding that trust and confidence of our allies in a less bellicose way.
Tom, it wouldn't be an IFG podcast unless we mentioned the impending general election. We might get a new government. We might get a continuation of the current government. Whoever is in power after the election, what should their priorities be for foreign policy based on the arguments that you've set out?
Well, I suppose, in reality, as I experienced number 10, so much of what defines you in terms of your foreign policy will be reacting to events. It will be tactical. It will be handling whatever's in the inbox that they face in the first few months. You know, working for Gordon Brown, one of the first things we dealt with was trying to avoid a civil war in Kenya. And we would never have predicted that as at the top of his inbox. Look, clearly right up there is going to be Ukraine. Right up there will be whatever comes next on the Middle East, trying to get back to that kind of political horizon, trying to salvage the two-state solution, trying to get away from the hardliners in Hamas and in the Netanyahu government, who want to basically bury the prospects of that two-state solution. But then also, you know, whichever American wins, whichever sort of 80-year-old American wins in November, we're going to have a massive job to do to be at the table with the Americans and start to get back to the situation where we kind of worked out what was the global to-do list, rather than, as has happened in the last few years at moments, appearing on that global to-do list. And I think we've seen that actually in the last few months with David Cameron. I think we've seen that the UK is back at that table, is in that conversation once again, and that's quite positive. But that will be a real, whoever comes in the UK, building that credibility rapidly will be very, very important.
Tom, you've just mentioned David Cameron, which brings us on nicely to that discussion. Let's take a closer look at the person who is currently in charge of the Foreign Office. David Cameron, it feels like, has been pretty much everywhere since he made the shock return to government. What did you make of Cameron's comeback, and what do you make of how he's approached the role so far?
Well, I think obviously I'm biased because I worked for him for a year in number 10, so I've seen him in action, and you know, I know how good he is at this. And it was striking, you know, just looking at that US visit the last few days, the complexities of, you know, meeting Donald Trump, that incredibly kind of busy agenda with Tony Blinken, trying to get in to see the right people in Congress and so on. You know, it's quite a tough act to pull off, but he does have, you know, he's got the experience, he's got the profile, he knows the issues. You know, it's not his first rodeo, and you can really see that. And I think my impression is that the Foreign Office has responded very well to that, that there is a sense of purpose and mojo in the organization that some of us have been really hoping to see for some time. And I think that has been absent, if we're honest, for under a number of foreign secretaries. So I'm on the positive side. I think it's been very good for the Foreign Office. And I like the idea that our leaders, with all that experience, do stay on the park in some way. I think as the UK, we don't always do enough to use some of these people with immense experience. You know, just looking out there at some of these people like Cathy Ashton and Valerie Amos, and these brilliant people who've served at very senior levels in the international system, or who've served at very senior levels in our own government, we should really be deploying them as much as possible. And I think David Cameron's shown how to do that.
Alex, do you think we make enough of the people that we have already with lots of experience in foreign policy?
I think I totally agree with Tom. I think we can and should make more of them. I mean, clearly there's a government just made out of people from the past. You need the energy and dynamism and fresh ideas from the future. But I think also the role of foreign secretary is particularly kind of well suited to this. I mean, one of the things that has been so striking about Cameron, and we may be in a very unusual point where we have a prime minister who happens to be less interested in foreign policy and has got plenty of issues he needs to deal with on the domestic side, and is unusually happy to delegate kind of large chunks of foreign policy to a big figure. And actually, for all the criticisms leveled at Rishi Sunak, is self-confident enough, clearly, in this sphere at least, to delegate that responsibility. I also think, I mean, the job of a prime minister, we've written a lot about this recently with our commission on the centre of government, the job of a prime minister is not really a possible job to do. There aren't enough hours in the day, there's not enough support around the job and so on. So however you choose to release some of the burden of that, there are certain things that can only be done at a head of government level. We have the G7 meetings and other sort of leader to leader conversations that are absolutely essential. But if Rishi Sunak can bring back a big hitter, delegate a large chunk of the agenda to that, and seems to be getting results, then that's all to the good. I can't think of many other prime ministers though who would come back and do that at the moment. So, final thought, I guess, is just how contingent that is on the politics of the moment. You know, William Hague came back as a former leader of the Conservative Party and did the job, but it's pretty dependent on having the right person there who is able to do the job at the right time.
No Blair for Foreign Secretary in the late 20s.
Oh well, you never know. And obviously, there's the Osborne mischievousness about bringing back Cameron, but my bit of mischievous on that is that I think Keir Starmer should think really seriously about keeping John Bew, who's the current foreign affairs advisor in number 10, who, you know, is not a sort of partisan figure, but is generally considered to have done a good job on this stuff. So, you know, Bew for continuity is my pitch.
I think there'd be a lot of support for that. I mean, that is hugely credible across administrations. If I could just add one thought on why it seems to be working at the moment, actually, with David Cameron as foreign secretary, I think there's also credit for Andrew Mitchell, you know, who obviously has experience in development, has his own clout, his own heft, his own ideas, but who's clearly very comfortable working alongside David Cameron. So that, you know, you don't get a sense looking in from outside that the two of them are kind of haggling over who handles which issue and so on. It feels like a very smooth running and genuinely equal dynamic in there. And I think that's part of the reason that the marriage, and whether it's an unhappy marriage or not, you know, it's we're past the stage of thinking about that. But that DFID FCO combination seems to me, as an observer from outside, to be working quite well at the moment.
And Tim, lots of praise for Cameron as foreign minister. Do you think that the kind of success that he has had so far has opened the door to more Lords ministers in the future?
I actually think it might go the other way, in that it's a very specific circumstance. He's a former PM. I don't think Starmer's going to put Blair or Brown into the upper house in his first sort of, you know, honours list. Like, I understand the argument and the point that Alex made earlier, sort of, you know, if you're going to give any Secretary of State role to someone in the Lords, it makes sense for it to be the foreign affairs job, because they're sort of, you know, away from domestic politics, etc., etc. But to go back to what we've been talking about earlier, domestic and foreign policy are not two separate fields anymore. And the idea that, you know, he doesn't have a constituency and therefore he doesn't have sort of skin in the kind of day to day, I don't think that's as relevant as it was, you know, maybe even 10 or 20 years ago. I also think Labour are quite angry about Cameron having this role. I mean, part of it is because of who he is. A lot of people in the foreign policy space think he's done very well. The polling on him is very low. He gets super negative ratings. The public at large do not like David Cameron. And Labour do not like David Cameron, and they don't like the fact that they're unable to ask questions. MPs are unable to ask questions of the Foreign Secretary in Parliament at a time when foreign affairs is so important to everything that's happening here in the UK. So I think actually, you know, agree with everything that's been said, but I think this might be the last time we have someone like this. Obviously, in the past, Labour did have big hitters in the Lords in domestic briefs as well. But I don't think it's going to happen again anytime soon.
And in your view, that scrutiny question hasn't been adequately addressed?
No, I think not. I mean, David Lammy was on Laura Koonsberg at the weekend sort of complaining about the fact that the Commons can't ask the foreign set questions about these big foreign policy dossiers. And I think the Commons has taken its sweet time to sort out a way to asking questions. Obviously, they could do that faster if they wanted to, but the government perhaps isn't prioritising that use of parliamentary time. But yeah, I think it's never going to be the same as having a MP who is a Secretary of State who comes for monthly or six-weekly question sessions, who goes in front of the select committee of their peers with a small p. And if I'm wrong, I'll put my hands up, but I can't see it happening quite this way anytime soon.
I do completely agree that the scrutiny point needs to be resolved, and that's the real missing gap. And we've seen it over the Israel-Gaza questions and things we may come on to talk about in a moment. I'm a little bit more sympathetic, I think, to the Lords Minister point. If you get the scrutiny and accountability right, there's nothing magic about having a minister who happens also to be an MP. Obviously, most ministers should be, and the Prime Minister and most of the government should be drawn from the House of Commons. But I think there's a there's a value to the House of Lords, and there's a value to bringing back previous experience. And as you said, we had eminent Lord Chancellors and others in the Labour government bringing back that expertise. So I'm possibly a tiny bit more upbeat about Lords Ministers than you are, Tim. But we'll leave it.
Yeah,
there.
The experience is good, but it's about the wider sort of democratic question, I think. Yeah.
Okay, let's turn next to the tricky question of how aspects of UK foreign policy, particularly when it involves military action or weapons, are the responsibility of the UK civil servants. Last week, we learned that the Public and Commercial Services Union, PCS, which represents civil servants, has called for an urgent meeting with the business department to discuss the legal jeopardy faced by civil servants working on arms sales to Israel. Alex, civil servants must find themselves relatively often working on policies that they're not comfortable with. Does this feel different to that?
Yeah, it does a little bit, because there's some ambiguities about what the responsibilities and obligations are on civil servants. I mean, as you imply there, Emma, of course, all the time as a civil servant, Tom and I and Tim have all experienced this. You might find yourself working on a policy that you're personally not wild about, or you have some ethical questions about. Sometimes you move to do some different work if you're that uncomfortable. Most of the time, frankly, you say, this is a democratically elected government taking these decisions. I'm going to suck it up and absolutely give my all to be professional and to do the best job that I possibly can. I think for all the incredibly fraught and personal and difficult ethical questions around the Israel-Gaza conflict, exactly the same principle applies to that. Those civil servants in the Foreign Office, elsewhere across government, this touches on all sorts of different parts of government, absolutely need to put their professions in front and center, their personal views separately. There's this narrow question, though, which the PCS has, which is the Civil Service Union for the more junior civil servants, has alighted on about the legality of the government's arms sales to Israel, which are very small, but which, nonetheless, kind of symbolically very important. And there is a question under some of our international legal obligations over whether it is, legal for those arms sales to continue. And at least for a period, David Cameron, it's that man again, has come out and clarified that in his view, this is legal. They've taken legal advice and he's given a little bit more information on that, which is good. But for quite a period, it seemed uncertain, and the Foreign Office in the government was being quite evasive over under what legal framework and what legal advice had been given on this question of arms sales and how that fit with that, accusations that Israel was committing genocide or war crimes. This does go to a wider debate about the extent to which international law bites on civil servants. Clearly, nobody disputes that domestic law, civil servants have to follow domestic law, but civil servants under the Civil Service Code have to obey the law and only pursue activity that is lawful. International law is a sort of question at dispute. And most people sort of involved in this world would have some sympathy for the suggestion that international law is caught by the Civil Service Code, although there are others who dispute that. And we've seen this in the Israel-Gaza situation, but also in the Rwanda deportations, where there is an ambiguity over under what legal authority civil servants are operating. And the government, for political reasons, diplomatic reasons, other reasons, has been reluctant to kind of come out and be very clear that they've had legal advice that says it is okay for civil servants to do this. So whether it's, whichever civil service union is pursuing the question of the legality of civil service activity under this, civil servants deserve clarity about that issue.
And as you say, the unions have been at the heart of this, or at least PCS in the last week. Tell us a bit more about how the relationship between the civil service and unions work.
Well, civil service unions are in quite an odd and interesting situation, because they do all the normal things that unions do. They you know, lobby for the employment terms of their members. They get into disputes with their employer about pay. They represent individual civil servants who might be having a beef with their employer. But at the same time, their employer is the government, and their members are under an obligation to be impartial. I mean, I think there should be a fairly tight self-denying ordinance on civil service unions to do all of those things that involve representing their members, which would include clarifying the legal situation, as I was setting out a minute ago. But they then don't get involved in the broader political debate. And some of those critics of PCS, this particular union, would say that they have not fought that shy of getting involved in political debates in the past. I remember, this is going back more than 20 years, when I started in the civil service, PCS campaigned and was very active in demonstrations against the Iraq War. As a member of PCS at the time, I'd sort of just signed up as part of joining the civil service. I felt quite uncomfortable with that, and I actually resigned from PCS at the time. They've also said some pretty, you know, there's been some pretty uncompromising language about the government's policy position on the Israel-Gaza question at the moment. And I think it is quite difficult for a union that represents civil servants to do the day job really well in the context in which civil service unions operate if they're inserting themselves into some of those political debates. I mean, that's my personal view, but you know, it's tough.
Can I just jump in with two quick thoughts? Because I'd very much agree with that, all of that. One story, actually, and here we go with David Cameron again, but when I was out in Lebanon, I tweeted from my HMA Tom Fletcher account, an official government account, solidarity with those who were on a civil service strike. And it was blasted up on the Sky News screen. And I got a message pretty quickly from David Cameron as Prime Minister to say, in no uncertain terms, what are you up to? And he was dead right. I could have protested in person in the street as a member of the union, but using a government social media account, for me, having thought a lot about social media over the years, was clearly out of bounds. And then just on the Israel and export licenses are really, really tricky. If you're sat there on the desk or as a head of department or director, they always make you feel uncomfortable because it's such a kind of complex area. If I was in the department now, I think the question I would be asking experts is, are the weapons we're talking about being used genuinely for self-defense? So, you know, anything in support of the Iron Dome, for example, the most sophisticated self-defense mechanism in the world that protects Israel from rocket strikes, I think is personally legit. But I would be much more worried about anything that's being used for hitting hospitals, schools, and civilian areas. I would be asking that question to see if that helps to make some of these questions easier to answer.
Tim, does the kind of discussions that we've seen from PCS, from civil servants in the last week, does it show a tendency of the civil service to be more outspoken in recent years?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, it's always difficult to sort of compare different moments, right? But I think since the referendum, sort of, there's been a lot of criticism of the civil service by politicians. And I think in recent years, we've seen sort of sometimes the civil service kind of pushing back on some of that and also being willing to take the fight to the conservative governments in a way that maybe wouldn't happen before. I think what Alex was saying about international law has become quite sort of totemic in these debates is quite interesting. You know, so around Brexit, there was all the issues around the Windsor Framework and Northern Ireland and that kind of thing, and whether or not the civil service would be breaking international law under that. So I think that is... It does feel like quite a sort of late 2010s, early 2020s issue. I also think what's interesting on this particular topic, the Israel-Gaza war, because it is such a kind of totemic issue, it's so emotive, it's not just happening in the UK. We've seen in the State Department in the US, we've seen civil servants kind of raising concerns about the US government's policy. I was reading that last December, Dutch civil servants in their Ministry of Foreign Affairs had a sit-in outside their HQ in The Hague. Recently, German civil servants from across the federal government in Germany have written to the Chancellor there saying that they disagree with his government's approach to supporting Israel. So it's not just a UK thing. I think, you know, whether it's social media, whether it's just sort of a kind of a broader discussion of policy issues in the world, that civil servants in general seem more willing to speak out in their capacity as civil servants rather than as private citizens and take arguments to their governments, which wasn't so much of a thing, I think, 10 or 20 years ago.
Really interesting. So a global trend, not just a domestic one. Tom, can you cast your mind back to when you were a number 10 foreign policy advisor? How much harder do you think that job is now, given the kind of tensions and conflicts that we're seeing across the globe?
I think it's always a very hard job, you know, as a survivor. And I've just huge respect for the team doing it now. And yeah, anyone who gets stuck into those jobs, because there's immense sacrifice there. I don't know. I mean, there's, you know, once you get into number 10, certainly in my working lifetime, you know, it is quite political with a small p, in a way that working for other departments isn't. You do feel much more on that sort of front line of the political agenda. And often the friction between number 10 and departments is around exactly that. That grey area around what, you know, what is government policy and what is politics, and in number 10 you're making those decisions every day. Has it got harder? I think perhaps not at the moment, but you can see as an observer certainly some of the Home Office stuff in recent years, Rwanda migration and so on. That, you know, that I think that would have been where tougher actually than in number 10. I think the threat to break international law, fortunately, only a threat in the end. Would have been, I think if we had really crossed that line, that would have been a make or break issue for a lot of senior civil servants. And, it, you know, we got pretty close to that point. But I think some of that, as Tim's saying, I think has receded now.
We actually got pretty close, it felt to me at the time, to breaking domestic law, which was on the legislation around the no-deal Brexit and requesting an extension and so on. That was the thing that really got me when I was a civil servant and caused me problems. But the point I was going to add to what Tom said, so I was in the Cabinet Office when Trump was first elected, and I wasn't close particularly to the Foreign Affairs side, but I do get a sense there was a bit of an underestimation of just what a gear shift that would prove to be, because it's tempting to get into the debates we've been talking about Ukraine, Israel, Gaza, all the other kind of tension and flashpoints. But you can get accused of being too obsessed sometimes with American politics, and no doubt lots of us in the Westminster and Whitehall villages are. But it all revolves around whether Trump is elected or not. And I think the sense in which a continuing Sunak government or a Starmer government have a merely tough or totally impossibly incomprehensibly tough time on foreign affairs depends on the Trump question, because that will affect the amount of our GDP we should be spending on defence. That will affect all our kind of global alliances. And I think this sense that Trump could be treated quasi normally and constrained within the, you know, the Five Eyes intelligence sharing arrangements that we have, and the general kind of the thickness of the defense and security contacts that the UK has with the United States foreign policy establishment, barely held if at all in the first Trump presidency, and I think in a second would be sort of completely explosive. And so I hope that those in number 10 are not underestimating what profound consequences that would have. I say with trepidation, knowing that Tom is on the call, because he knows far more about all of this than I do.
No, there's no doubt that Trump is a major threat to our values and our interests, and Trump 2.0 should terrify us for the things he'll do, but also for the things he won't do, for the time that we will lose on some of those huge long-term challenges that our report talked about. Losing 4 years on the battle against climate change, you know, it's just unthinkable.
All eyes to this autumn. Okay, well, that's all we've got time for this week on Inside Briefing. Many thanks to Tim, Alex, and especially to you, Tom. Thanks for being with us. Remember, you can find Inside Briefing in Acast, Spotify, iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts. Please do subscribe and leave us a good review. And if you want more international affairs content, then check out last week's Expert Factor, our podcast with the IFS and UK Interchanging Europe. It takes a deep dive into the US presidential election. And if you or anyone you know is interested in working with us at the IFG, then why not apply for one of our research internships? Applications are open until April the 30th, so head to our website for more details and do get in touch with any questions. Parliament is back next week. Local elections are fast approaching. Domestic politics is hotting up. But as this episode has shown, you can be sure that international affairs are going to be felt right across government in the months ahead. See you next week.